Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Tom, I'll start with you. If you don't mind, just a quick self-introduction, and I'll move on to John.
Yeah, thank you so much. Tom Cook here. I'm co-founder and CEO of Spacely Incorporated, a gig marketplace for the aerospace industry.
Thanks so much, Tom. I appreciate it. John, please introduce yourself.
John Younger. I'm the least important member of this group. I write the Freelance Revolution blog for Forbes, write in some other places, and I'm trying to create as much trouble as I possibly can within this freelance revolution.
Yeah, well, you're succeeding. Thanks so much, John. Last but not least, Rich.
Hey, yeah, I'm Rich Wilson. I'm the founder and CEO of GigDAI. We're an open talent marketplace for digital and tech talent. I apologize if, obviously, there's no subtitles available. I am from Glasgow in the UK. Some Americans understand me, some don't. So I'm going to try and speak as slowly as I can for the next hour or so. So I apologize for the lack of subtitles.
No need for apologies. This is definitely an exciting group of people. I'm personally excited about to, you know, learn a little bit more and get you guys' thoughts on just a very pressing topic of, you know, the freelance and the status of the gig economy in general with the markets that we're in. The war on talent, the war on retention is real. So this is a definitely exciting conversation. Tom, if you don't mind, just tell us a little bit more about the solution that you're currently building and what was the motivation behind it?
Yeah, thank you, John. We put together the team in January 2020, prior to the pandemic. And some of the rationale that we were seeing at the time was everything was becoming fractionalized, right? And so if you want to get a fractional second home, you go to Picasso. If you get a fractional car, you can go to Turo. You get a, you know, Airbnb. And so when we were looking at that model, we were seeing if that actually extended into talent as well. And personally, for me, I was in the military for 24 years. And if you look at some of the things we do in the military, it's actually a fractional model in some instances, right? So if you go into combat, that may not be your full-time job, right? You hope it isn't. But then you go in for a short period of time. And so we're looking at really how do you optimize and create efficiencies out of your resources, whatever those be, right? And we were getting excited about seeing all the different applications that are out there to show that we could better optimize for, you know, whatever those resources are. So when I retired from the military in 2017, I began researching this and came across Reimagining Work, Rob Biederman's book, who was the chairman and CEO of Catalamp before moving over to a venture fund. And it just really struck me of looking at how do you structure work differently, right, in the future. And when we look at this and you look at the models that are out there, you know, we were having the same conversation years ago about could you have a fully remote company, right? Everybody that's working remote. And now that doesn't seem so odd, even though that did 10 or 15 years ago. And so that trend accelerated, obviously, with the pandemic. But what was more important to me and our team, what we were trying to do was basically was this idea of creating stackable skills, stackable credentials, stackable work through project and task-based work, and allow people to start structuring work that best suited them. It's very tough. You know, if you look at traditional employment processes, HR, the model itself, it's kind of a vanilla layer for everyone. Everyone kind of has to fit into the same kind of scope of whatever that company is. And, you know, we're all individuals and we all have different individual challenges, desires. We want to have some flexibility and optionality in how we approach life, and it's going to change throughout life as well. I'm fortunate. I've got a wife and two daughters. How I'm working now is different than how I was working when I was single. And, you know, and as the daughters move out of the house, I'll probably work differently as an empty nester. And so we wanted to account for the fact that no one's really looking at coming out of any type of training or schooling and saying, I want to work for this one company for 30 years. But there's a tremendous amount of, especially in the knowledge economy, you know, skills that really work for multiple industries simultaneously. And so if you're really working for one, your talent and expertise and your skills are really locked in to that one company for however long you are. And so we really wanted to create, as we're seeing these other open systems approach, mostly with software and hardware as well, could we have an open systems approach to talent as well, where we collaborate for it as opposed to compete for it, and allow people that have the ability to flexibly schedule it, manage it, optimize the resource, whether it's time or knowledge capacity, to bring that all together and obviously use our platform and, mm-hmm. and the digital means we have now to do that. So that's kind of how we put together our company as we were looking at the trend moving forward and fractionalizing everything.
I can definitely relate. I can definitely see a lot of need for service as such. And I want to double click on that a little bit further. But before we do that, Rich, can you share a little bit further about what problem are you solving with the solution that you guys are building?
Yeah, of course. So my background is a bit different. I was in the recruitment industry for 14 years. So I was a recruiter to a senior executive at a Legis Group. So I grew tech systems in Europe. I had that job for 14 years. So, you know, I used to run all the contractors in Europe, all tech. You know, we had over 5,000 contractors in the UK. We had, you know, 22,000 globally. So I spent a long time training, developing people in how to find contractors or freelancers, and then how to find work from clients, how to qualify projects. And after spending a long time, as I said, I plan to work there 25 years, then retire. After 14 years, I suffered from really bad burnout. Right? I was one of the senior leaders. And really, it was because we were working crazy hours, right? That hustle culture, I was working. Since the age of 21, I'd been working 12 to 14 hour days as a norm. And then I was bringing in lots of people who were doing the same, right? We're bringing in motivated, driven kids out of uni, training them to go and then find great freelancers. But again, we were having the same thing. We're having a lot of burnout, or a lot of people leave because of the intensity. And as I said, I had a similar talk. I've got a young family, I've got a seven-year-old daughter. For the first 3 years of life, I hadn't seen her. I was traveling, I was in the States a lot. I was traveling around offices, meeting sales teams, meeting new recruiters we were hiring. And I thought, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, the traditional staffing industry is too much. I don't want to do it anymore. And as I said, I could do that. I'd been in it. I'd earned my stripes. And I decided to take some time out. So I thought, you know, kind of similar to what Tom said, actually, at the start, but so I went and trained as an MMA fighter for 6 months, right? I got away from staffing. I'm like, I'm never doing it again. And then I was offered some board positions, one at the Data Lab, which is Scotland Centre for AI and Data. And I started spending some time with those guys, and they were trying to create more data jobs in Scotland, and they're trying to bring. And I started going, well, actually, the gig economy is a key thing we should be talking to these guys coming through about. And then, as kind of fate would have it, I met the chair of the Data Lab is a guy called John Brody, and John was just selling. He's a data scientist. He built a massive data science company and sold them to Merkle, a huge Japanese company. And we got talking, and I was like, I need some mentorship. At the time, I was then offered to go and work for Gartner for a few years, because I said I was so out of staffing. I was never going to work in staffing again. I was done. So I went to Gartner for a few years, and I was advising CEOs on data, digital products, and future of work. And especially in the UK, the whole, you know, thinking about using freelancers or contract, it wasn't really there, and there wasn't really a solution for UK companies. There's a lot of regulation in the UK. There's a lot of cultural things in the UK. So there was a huge demand for tech talent, but there wasn't really a solution here. So during lockdown in March 2020, we thought, look, let's create a simple way which allows clients to qualify project briefs, which then matches them instantly to quality vetted freelancers, that then means that they're not applying for things which are just, you know, crap job specs. And let's then wrap around lots of APIs to make the process a lot quicker, right? So we can onboard freelancers in less than an hour. Nobody in the UK can do that. You know, it takes at least a month to onboard the traditional contractor. So we wanted to really disrupt that traditional contract market. Or we need someone for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. Well, you don't. You've got a task that needs done and you need that task defined. So we thought, let's create an AI way to create that work package. You don't need a recruitment consultant to qualify it. And then you don't need a recruiter. Now, what I always say is, we're not saying that you don't need those people. Those people are really hugely influential as account managers and account execs. You need those people, but you just don't need them doing all the stuff that burns them out and takes all the time. There's tech that can do it. So yeah, we started March 2020 just as a side project. We launched the beta version of our open talent marketplace on March 21. We quit our jobs by June 21. So I left Gartner in June. And then we've had exponential growth, and we're just about to close the Series A to really allow us to grow internationally. But that was really, my background from being in the recruitment industry and then looking from a different view from Gartner, I was able to look at it holistically and go, we really need to be fixing some problems here and not just creating more talent platforms that just create more jobs and then get 400 applications for every gig that someone puts up. That's how's that innovative? How's that the future of work? That's what's happened in the staffing industry for 35 years. So I nearly went on a rant about staffing industry, but that was my that was where I came at it. So a little bit of a different background.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that, and definitely a very diverse background. And the problems that you saw as a practitioner in that space, I think translated to what you're currently trying to solve, which makes perfect sense. So John, hearing the both sides of the equation of what these guys are building in terms of the problems that they're solving in this space, and you do a lot of research in this and you do a lot of writing in that, share your thoughts on what's next. What are some of the trends that you personally very excited about, especially when it comes to how organizations hire, how organizations retain talent, and when it comes to leveraging, you know, the gig workforce for some of the most immediate needs? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. You know, let me shift the question just a little bit so that it's less about trends and more about three or four things that I worry about. So if I may talk in those terms, but before I do, I want to just comment on something that Tom said, because I think that it'll add a little bit. Tom, my impression is that you're solving a pretty big problem. And the pretty big problem is that anybody with a pea shooter now can shoot up a satellite. Well, we got a lot of satellites up there and they're banging around each other. And I don't know that we're thinking about them in the same way that we think about sort of avoiding planes from landing on each other. And so there's a tremendous technological requirement to understand how to manage these, if I understand it correctly, just within the next year or two. Amazon is gonna put up, 3,000 satellites? Yeah. Think about what Meta is gonna put out, think about what Google is putting out. Somebody needs to help in that industry. And my impression is that you're gonna play a key role in that. Is that fair?
That is fair. I mean, that's why we felt like there was a couple of trends that we were seeing, and you're hitting one of those, right? This incredible explosion advancement in commercial space companies, private investment coming in and building these space companies out, the future of work, as we've been talking about, where that intersection is. And then to your point, you look at the what we call the global space or the global commons, right? You've got shipping lanes, you have air corridors, you have national highways, and all the infrastructure. And really, this is a nascent time for that new infrastructure. And it's kind of like the old land grab of the, you know, Sooner State in Oklahoma, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If I can get there first, I can get my satellites up and I claim, you know, orbit. But to your point, there's so many folks that are launching so many things now because the cost of launch has significantly been reduced by, you know, mostly because of Elon Musk and what he did with reusability. And now everyone is, you know, investing in those launchers, investing in smaller technologies that can get to orbit. And you have, not only do you have that, that's really technical work, and then somewhat problematic because you are getting more congested and contested in that space, right? And you have to be able to account for deconfliction there. But you also have this idea that we're going to become you know, kind of interplanetary species, you know, with Elon Musk pushing, right? And we have a Mars lander, a lunar lander, a space hotel, all these things. And if we really have that type of vibrant, what I would consider vibrant space economy, it's going to take a lot of people to engage, a lot more than what we have right now. So that's what we're thinking. And because we have a current supply and demand mismatch in aerospace, we have over 16,000 open jobs here in the US open in aerospace. While we're still with 7 million unemployed Americans in a compelling and decent paying industry. So we know that there's something that's also causing that mismatch. And we also know we're going to see continued growth and need for the people to contribute to this growing space economy.
Let me add to that, that Rich's version of that is there are 300,000 open jobs in AI, just in the US. I mean, we're not even talking about the rest of the world. Supplying that technology is awfully important. So when we think, Jean, when you ask what's the stuff that I'm watching right now, what's the stuff that I worry about, I'll give you three or four things. One is that we are desperately in need of creating greater supply of full-time freelancers. Desperately. Big companies don't want to work with part-time folks. They don't want to work with part-time folks because reality is part-time folks are not as reliable because they have a full-time job as others. And so when you think about the construction of the freelance economy right now, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of all the freelancers are part-time. We need more if we're gonna reach escape velocity in really creating freelancing as another career venue, a true career venue, as opposed to just a path that seems to be available to some people, but not a lot. So that's the first. Second is, while three quarters to two thirds of the freelancers are part-time, what that means is that there's an extraordinary change effort happening within organizations, because 40% of the people working in those organizations have an alternative career venue. They have an alternative career option. They're making money as independents. They're gaining confidence. They're gaining a willingness to and an ability to step outside of part-time work and to become a full-time contractor or whatever they'd like to be. And as a result, what we're seeing now isn't really the great red, what do they call it? The great resignation. I think what we're experiencing is the great awakening, the great liberation of people who realize that they've got options. And so organizations, if they want full-time people, are going to have to do a much better job of managing the expectations of those individuals and providing them with the things that all freelancers want, which is greater autonomy, greater flexibility and independence, greater agency, the greater ability to have impact in what they do, and greater affiliation, because especially during COVID times, it's lonely out there. And so we want to feel like we're part of. Third thing is, it is extraordinary how quickly the freelance revolution is, as I call it, has swallowed the occupational world. And if we think about, I'll give you one small example. There are 10 million independent hairstylists in the world associated with one platform. 10 million. HoneyBook provides business in a box for 50,000 people in the business of personal training, Tom, like your wife. And so we're seeing an extraordinary explosion of that stuff. But the problem is, we now have to educate them to be entrepreneurs, to be solopreneurs, because many of them just don't know the basics of how to do that. How you build a brand, how you get clients, how you price your stuff, how you ensure that you're managing the business from a financially reasonable perspective, how to make sure you've got a good contract, how to get paid, I mean, all that stuff. So what's happening, I think, is that an extraordinary opportunity is meeting an extraordinary solution. The extraordinary opportunity is there is just so much change technically, professionally, commercially, that there's a great, huge opportunity available to millions of people who by nature of the accident of where they were born, perhaps in Kazakhstan, and certain things were not available to them just because they were born in Kazakhstan. All that stuff is now available to them through technology. And all of that stuff is available to them occupationally through freelancing. That's the opportunity. The need is, we have tremendous needs in key occupational areas that are going, as we've heard from both Tom and Rich, going begging because we don't have the resources. So we can bring those two together, and it will create a wonderful, wonderful scenario for millions of people that don't currently have the degree of that opportunity or haven't had access to responding to that need. So I am as excited as I could possibly be about what's going on. And I know that one of the questions is, do you really need full-time people to build an organization? And I think, you know, one version of that is you probably need some, but probably a lot less than you think, and probably for a lot in a very different way, constructed in a very different way than you think. And that is a very exciting thing, because at the end of the day, what we're doing is we are, through technology, we are reinventing the way in which organizations have operated for thousands of years, the way in which people have plied their career for thousands of years. And that, sir, is a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, are you experiencing similar observations as you, having these conversations with some of your clients, the hiring organizations? Are they facing the same challenges? Just share some thoughts from that perspective as well.
Yeah, their frustrations are exactly what, you know, Rich and John are talking about. You know, in the old days, to be in aerospace, you know, you kind of were siloed. You had an aerospace engineering degree, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, or something where folks said, okay, that seems like that fits the persona for an aerospace engineer. But as the technology continues to explode across, you know, all these industries, you're starting to see these convergent skill sets, especially in the data sciences and AI and ML. And so if you have a need for those convergent skill sets where the financial industry and the insurance, banking, whoever is requiring those same resources, and those industries are providing optionality and flexibility, but ours is not attuned to it, then it's really going to be difficult for you to compete holistically for the talent that's out there, because you're not providing the same types of pathways that other industries are for those similar skill sets. And that's one issue we've seen within aerospace, as they've come out of kind of a silo and they've come into, you know, all kinds of as a service products, software as a service, you know, hardware as a service. We're even talking about satellites as a service now and ground stations as a service. And so if you look at it that way, all of that, again, goes back to how do you optimize for those resources? You know, a ground station as a service is an interesting example, because to every constellation of satellites we built in the Air Force, you know, for years, had a dedicated ground station, right? And that has a huge cost. And we would always look to figure out how we could consolidate that so we can then free up those resources to build something else. And so in aerospace, we've definitely seen it. And the frustration is the clients we're talking to don't recognize that the data is out there that shows the average adult American stays in a job no longer than 4 years. Millennials were 18 months, and Gen Z is getting even more hype, what I consider hypermobile, right? And where they're going to be located, where they're going to be working, how frequently they move. And aerospace wants to say, hey, I want to invest in these folks, right? And if I'm going to make that investment in them, I want them to be around and stick around for a while. And I've been kind of talking with our clients about, why do you make it a binary decision? Because if that client leaves that employee leaves at any given time, right, after you've made that investment, maybe they have to go back to Minnesota to take care of a sick relative. Or maybe they're going to go to Boeing as opposed to Lockheed to have a lateral move to get increased responsibility and pay. And maybe that person was there for the, you know, 4 years or 5 years. Well, you've invested in that person, and now you just let them walk out the door and you watch them walk out the door. And if you have to account for NDAs and OCIs, you know, for whenever that is that they leave, you have to account for that for tomorrow, knowing that they could potentially leave tomorrow, right? If you have to account for them leaving anytime. And if you can account for them leaving tomorrow, you can account for them leaving today. Or in our case, what we're trying to, say is you can account for them working simultaneously for Boeing and Lockheed at the same time. And in our industry, in a hyper-competitive industry, somewhat still hierarchical in nature and very structured, that doesn't necessarily resonate all the time when we talk with our folks. And so there's this, you know, kind of balance of, well, I'm frustrated, I want to do more. We feel like, you know, we have really great talent, but we're still seeing the supply and demand mismatch. And our kind of pitch to them is two things. One, it's no longer good enough to say we do compelling work and pay well. That's not enough, right, for everyone. There's a lot of variability in there, and it's all very individualized in what people are looking for. And if you're trying to, again, put a vanilla layer on every person in the organization, that doesn't account for that individual scenario. And then the other thing we talk with them about is, to us, there's a difference between talent acquisition and talent access. And talent acquisition is the traditional, hey, I want to, as Rob Biederman says, hey, I want to bear hug you once you get in the organization. I want to hold on to you forever, right? And that's not accounting for the data that shows they're going to be moving. And so we're trying to let them know, hey, there's multiple pathways here. We're not necessarily saying all the future of work is going to be fractionalized and gig. But we do think if we invert the firm to some degree and compensate the folks that are giving up more in trade for full-time employment, right? Some of those, you know, like the 16, 80 hour work weeks and all that. And that's more of a traditional acquisition role. You can compensate that differently as opposed to growing your organization to tens of thousands of members where you're going to be unable to scale all those pay rates across the company, right? And then you're still trying to convince them, hey, I want you to do all of this for $120,000. And that's where some of this, you know, the mismatch becomes apparent, that folks are just not willing to give up some of these things for how the organization is structured. And they're just limited in how they can actually resource and fund, you know, all the people they want to work with. So for us, it's not about trying to acquire all those people. It's also about accessing them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely very interesting observations. And thank you for sharing that. Rich, are you seeing similarities in international markets as you operate more on the, you know, the European side of things? Share your research, some of the things that you're observing in your space.
Yeah, so kind of similar to what John said. So if you look at the Great Resignation or the Great Reawakening, I like that. So we're seeing how it's really impacting both sides of the demographic, right? So if we look at those, no, I don't want to say, let's say the more experienced people who are resigning, right? Senior execs at major consultancies, you know, Cisco, Accenture, Deloitte, PwC. You've got a lot of people who would have stayed there until they're 65, which is the retirement age here. But they're leaving in their mid-40s to early 50s now. Now, they're not retiring, though. They're just going to go to a much more flexible type of work. They're freelancing, right? They might not call it that, but they're freelancing. They're advising. They're, you know, helping all of us. They go and help a lot of startups for a fee, right? They're freelancing. Then at the other side of the equation, you've got 54% of Gen Zs coming into the workforce don't want a perm job, right? So you then have young kids coming in that don't want a perm job, right? Because the perm job, to what Tom said, you know, I think the average in the UK is 2.5 years is how long you stay in a perm job. I would imagine when new data comes out, it'll be much less than that. You know, we've got software developers in the UK who will take a job at a major bank and then will leave that within 6 months to take a, you know, for a $40,000 increase, $50,000 increase. So I'd imagine it's lower than that. But that challenge, so what that then does is an interesting thing. It brings some really interesting talent in. So it brings some experienced talent that have worked for major consultancies and major organizations that's then looking to work in a flexible way. And then you've got much younger guys coming in that maybe don't have all the experience, but they have, you know, skills that, you know, let's say UX design, graphic design, Web3 skills, like various skills that they have used because they have, you know, worked in projects and everything else, really a valuable resource, don't want to do perm. So then that perm market is then in a real tricky place. And then that's when the kind of challenge that John mentioned. So how do you educate? And this is something we're talking about. So, you know, you could be in your mid-50s and quit your big job at Accenture and then go and work through various platforms, but you've never done that. You've never ran a business that way. You've got great knowledge, but you've never done it. You're a Gen Z, you come on. You've never, you know what you want to do. You get offered, you know, you go and work through one of the platforms and you're starting to earn some pretty good money, right? You could be a graphic designer, a UX designer, might not have great experience, but you're really talented, starting to earn some good money through various platforms. You've got money coming into the bank. But the problem you have at both sides is, right, what accounting software are you doing? You're actually now running a business. You're a small business owner now. So, you know, how do you then build all the relationships with other freelancers? How do you collaborate? How do you know what platforms you should work with, what ones you don't? How do you build your brand? How do you use LinkedIn, you know, TikTok, whatever it is, to then market your brand to others? So there's a massive education to various ends of that great resignation divide, if you know what I mean. So that's something that we're very aware of at the moment and trying to look at, because the experience and the talent is there, but there is a support needed. And then on the flip side, and this is where the UK market really differs from the US market. Trying to get a client, whether they're an enterprise or whether they're a small, to actually trust the talent platform, whether it's the big ones like your Upworks, your Fiverrs, or up and coming ones like ourselves, that model is still not really in the thinking, right? It's either I hire a permanent resource or I hire a long-term contractor. Taskification through platforms is still, you know, it's still not in the general zeitgeist. It's still just there. So it's education. It's educating clients and people how they can really benefit freelance, but then those that are choosing freelance and educating them about how they can get the best out of it. So it's a really, that trend is only going to get bigger, I think.
That's great observations, Rich. Thank you for sharing that. And take that a little bit further, John, through your research or, you know, everything you're observing in the current markets, what are the biggest threats that could impede to, you know, the growth of the gig worker, the freelancer community as it relates to, you know, the client's hiring company education and being able to leverage opportunities with the freelancers and gig workers as we move on, you know, through the, I guess, the current conditions of the market? Just share some thoughts from that perspective.
Sure. I'll give you a couple, three. And I certainly buy what Rich has just said. I think it's very important to understand that a lot of these folks are technically very sophisticated, but are not commercially savvy in terms of themselves. You know, it's one thing for Jean, you've been a VC, you've been a co-founder of companies. It's one thing to know how to build a company. It's another thing to know how to sell yourself. They're very different skill sets, and it's important to understand the distinction. So one of the things that I think that we're talking about that's very important is making sure that you're providing education to these freelancers that they won't get somewhere else. Tom, how much time on an annual basis did you have in education while you were in the armed forces? At least a month, right? You probably had a month a year of staying up to date. Freelancers don't have that. You know, so the challenge is that too often, John, we're not creating incubators. We're not creating accelerators for individual talent. What we're creating are warehouses for talent, and hoping that at least some percentage of the people that are warehoused are saleable on an annual basis. That's a shame. That's not a very good model. Second is that so much of the freelance platform world is hub and spokes, right? It's the old SaaS model where I have a relationship with each of my freelancers, but they don't have a relationship with one another. Well, that's crazy, because how do we improve? How do we grow? How do we develop if all that exchange is transactional, if I may put it that way, instead of building a strong community? Third thing is that what we know from our research is that while the rest of the world is going to figure it out, it's going to do so at different rates of speed. And so when you take a look, for example, at Africa, where I happened to do some work and was invited to participate in some interesting programs, what we know is that clients aren't very sophisticated yet. They're not used to it. They know how to work with McKinsey. They know how to work with BCG. They know how to work with Accenture. They know how to work with WPP, but they don't know how to work with Bill, Susan, and Bob. And they don't, because, you know, when you hire McKinsey, what's the old expression? Nobody ever failed by hiring McKinsey, right? Well, you know, but we're the unknown right now. And so we've got to build enough credibility so that we're seen as a reasonable alternative. And the issue isn't how do we allay risk, the issue is how do we improve performance. And I guess the fourth thing that I would say is that, and this is a personal piece for me, and Jean, you and I have talked about it separately. You know, we've got let's say 1,000 platforms out there, more or less. I talk to 5 to 7 every week of new platforms that are saying, you know, I'd like to introduce myself to you. Maybe you can write about me. And if you can't write about me, can you introduce me to somebody, et cetera? So we've got 1,000 platforms that are all making their own education. They're all making their own onboarding stuff. They're all making their own monthly webinars to learn about how to price, how to sell, how to build relationships, et cetera. The last time I looked, Tom and Rich were not educators. The last time I looked, they were business builders, and somebody needs to help them to provide them with the kind of commodity education that they don't need to spend time working on. Because at the end of the day, figuring out how to price your service on a daily basis is not something that is truly unique to the satellite industry or to the Scottish tech industry. So one of the things that we've got to do a better job of in all of these areas, if we want this to grow, is we've got to do a better job of building supporting ecosystems. We've got some of that in place. Some of it in terms of financial services, but not much. Some in terms of education, but not much. We've got to think about the full benefit and value of these platforms as being educators, as being business builders, as being business supporters, as being service providers, because they've got to they've got to fill some of the holes that are left as we leave full-time organizations. So I'm very excited about this stuff. I think this stuff is going to happen. I'm also an old guy, so I want it to happen faster because I don't have time to wait for all this shit. I want to see more of this now.
Right. Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing those thoughts. In closure, I'd love to get your personal thoughts, Tom and Rich, in terms of how do you guys personally think about hiring and staffing for your own teams? How do you go about talent retention? How do you go about attracting top talent on a global scale, fully virtual environments, maybe leveraging the freelance and gig worker communities to fulfill some of the immediate needs that you have at your organizations? Tom, can you share some of the strategies from that perspective with us?
Yeah, you know, for us, we started out with, you know, bootstrapping the company. And so as we're trying to do that, we're looking at strategically, what do we need to do? What was our tech roadmap? What was our strategic roadmap? How do we get the resources to start to execute against building a business in for us, the most efficient way, because, you know, we knew what our runway was and what we had. And when we looked at it, we said, there's a real great opportunity here to not just, you know, pick one person and pay them, you know, $100,000-$200,000, which they're probably worth, but that person and I are only limited in what we could do, and, you know, with that money. But if I could spread that around and hire a fractional CTO like we did, and hire a platform as a service like we did to take advantage of other investments that other people were making in that platform, could I start to make us look bigger than what we were, right? As we were getting out of the gate. And then as we were also out there trying to advocate for, implementation of bringing this type of service into aerospace as a means to reaching talent, we felt, I hate to say it this way, but, you know, felt somewhat hypocritical to say, yeah, but we're going to hire 100 full-time employees, you know, for what we do at Spacely. Going back to my wife's business, she has a studio, a kickboxing studio. She used the MindBody platform. It had, automated scheduling, point of sale, all kinds of reports you can generate for your CPA, all those things. And she didn't have to, build any of that, right? It was already built and it was already funded by a lot of other people around, the world. And she was able to take advantage of that and have a studio that was able to extend into a larger community than had she not had those tools, right, and resources. And to John's point, I think that's where we were really excited about getting to, is how can we, as we grow internally, right, look at it the way we did as we were scrappy startups, and then look at it in the same way. In a two-sided marketplace, you're looking at client and talent, supply and demand. How do you simultaneously provide what they need on the supply side from people that you would consider that would be fractional workers for Spacely? Like, so do you think that if I have a fractional worker or a full-time, a traditional full-time hire, that I'm going to be even more or less concerned about my clients and my talent that are on the marketplace? And I feel like if you look at it that way, you can say, well, of course, you know, I'm a dad, I'm a husband, I'm a business owner. I love all of those things differently and in different ways. And I'm fractionalizing my time between those things, but it doesn't mean that I'm not putting as much as I can into all of that, right? And so if we look at how we've structured our lives anyway, and how we're fractional in nature, and how we're going about our day-to-day life and creating fractional revenue streams, passive income, whatever we're trying to do, then for us, it's part of our DNA and what we're doing in our company. And we also believe that we can grow more quickly by, you know, utilizing the fractional talent that buys into our vision.
Right, absolutely.
Can I ask one question before we change? And John, you're the CTO and co-founder of a number of organizations. Rich, Tom, John, can you build a business with a part-time CTO?
I feel like we've had a lot of success in our 2 years that we've been in business, and we've had a fractional CTO the entire time. Getting a small team like ours on a five-year NASA contract that was initially a $25 million contract, and now they've recently upped it to $175 million. I think we're hopefully showing what the art of the possible is. Also, even the other space companies that are raising funds, you know, getting through series financing rounds, and showing that a small scrappy startup with the right resources, the right access to the right talent, can bring together the right solution at the right time for the right price. And, you know, for us to be part of that that qualified pool of vendors for NASA, hopefully signifies that, you know, that we had some ability to show that even with fractional talent, we had someone like NASA believe that we had the right resources that they needed from our company.
John and Rich, what do you guys think?
So for us, it was a bit of a labor of love for us initially. So we were we were doing our full-time jobs and everything else, but we had a passion that we thought, let's build a product or a suite of products that we can then actually get launched, get traction, and then we can grow. So we used 33, I think, freelancers. So our first freelancer designed a logo. We then hired a lead designer and a few designers. We then hired nearly 15 AI engineers from all over the world, Portugal, Denmark, India, all our marketing, UX, UI, all freelance. So we got to a $10 million valuation without having one full-time employee. We had no full-time. We were still in our other jobs, and all of our team were freelance. We have a core of permanent team now, partially because VCs want to see that, but partially there were certain skills that we wanted to have full-time in, right? Audit manager. But for example, our CFO, she's a freelancer. Our marketing manager, freelancer. Lead developer, freelancer. So we still have more of our team freelance. And we'll continue to do that, right? So, as I said, there's a couple of some skills we brought in-house. We brought some of the data scientists in-house because, again, there are some changes that you need to make quickly. There's data ethics. There are certain roles that make life easier if you have it continually permanent. But, as I said, we'll always, you know, like all our blog writing, everything we do, we freelance everything. Because, again, it's to what Tom said, you got to practice what you preach, right? You know, I won't name names. I talked to a big, big freelance platform the other day who have a policy not to use freelancers. Like, that boggles my mind. How can you be a freelance platform and not use freelancers? But anyway, so, but yeah, no, you can. You know, we're on an AI accelerator just now with Edinburgh University. Way smarter startups than we, right? Some of them are curing cancer. They're helping people with mechanical limbs, way cleverer than us. We always get, you know, imposter syndrome with these guys, but they all have fractional CTOs. None of them have got the money to hire. So they're all building with fractional CTOs, CMOs, you name it. So absolutely yes, resounding yes to that.
What do you think, Jean?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely resonates with both what Tom and Rich talked about. Obviously, to a certain extent, that as you scale, as you grow, there's going to be different needs. But absolutely, especially at the early stages, at the startup stages, there's a lot of opportunity, not only on the technical side, but all sides of the equation of the organization. I think there's just so much opportunity to leverage, you know, the fractional CTOs, CMOs, CFOs. I see that every day in organizations of various size, utilizing services as such, solutions as such. So absolutely 100% resonates with what these guys are talking about, which are definitely very exciting trends with where organizations on a global scale can go and how they can utilize, you know, take advantage of the current quote unquote problems in the talent space and utilize, you know, services like yours guys to be able to, you know, outcompete the organizations that have the resources, have the benefit packages and things like that to offer their candidates. So that's absolutely very exciting. In closure, guys, I would love to kind of do a quick roundtable in terms of what is the best career advice that you had received early on in your guys' careers that you still refer back to even these days and even share with others as you guys grow your organizations? Tom, if you don't mind, I'll start with you.
Well, I mean, everything, even as we go into this, you know, digital environment, metaverse, Web3, DAO, it still comes down to people, right? And how you treat one another, how you engage with one another, what soft skills you have along with your hard skills, right, that the folks are looking for. And I think that's going to be one of the interesting things about where people find community and where they find a home. You know, before it was kind of religion or neighborhoods, schools, backgrounds that resonated. And I feel like as people get into maybe even a more chaotic atmosphere, it's not as structured as having, you know, kind of neighborhood schools and churches and everything. And that gets really mushy because we're in a digital environment. We don't know where to go and where to find other people. But it gives us that, you know, increased scalable opportunity to do that, right? And not just be, and that's why I left, you know, my home in Virginia. I love my home. I love my family. But I went out there and I said, what else is out here in the world beyond, you know, Shenandoah Valley and Appalachia region, right? And I feel like the digital environment is going to give folks that. But at the end of the day, and John had highlighted it, you know, you don't want to feel lonely and you got to have the connection and you want to find other people that can enjoy that journey with you. And so that's the biggest thing for us is, you know, there's a lot of talk about technology, AI, all this other stuff, you know, upending work. But at the end of the day, it all comes back to, you know, how we, you know, interact with one another as people.
I love it. I love it. Very powerful advice. Rich, what about you?
Yeah, so being Scottish, Scotland's not great at sports, but one of the sports that we're okay at is rugby. So growing up, right, so you can't really see me that well, but I'm really skinny, right, and tall. I was never excelling at rugby. So the only thing I got out of rugby, somebody gave me a book, and it was a book I read, and it was about the All Blacks. My cousin's from New Zealand, and I read it. And one of the things that struck for me from an early age, and I think it's so important now, was, I don't know if this is a swear word in America, but anyway, don't be a dick, right? And I think that is my number one. As freelancing goes, as the global economy grows, you know, we work with people all over the world all the time. This is my 12th call today with people all over the world. I've met amazing people in the last few years from being part of the freelance economy, and there's so many great people. And I think that for me is just continuing to be the thing. Freelance is hard, building businesses are hard, everything we're doing is hard, lockdowns are hard. Be a good person, be kind, don't be a dick. I could say something more profound, but that's really the one that it all comes back to for me.
I love it. Thanks for sharing that, Rich. Last but not least, John, please share with us some words of wisdom.
Well, I like don't be a dick.
Yeah,
I like that very much. I think that right now the best advice I can give anybody, and the best advice I can give myself, is to buckle up, because the next few years are going to be a hell of a ride. And who knows all of the stuff? I mean, between all the stuff that's going on internationally and all the stuff that's going on technologically and all the stuff that's going on with COVID, what an interesting time we live in. Isn't that the old expression, what live in interesting times? And I think that one of those interesting dimensions is the numbers and percentages of people all over the world that are saying, I don't know how to do it, I don't know if I'll be successful, but working for a dick isn't my idea of how I want to spend the rest of my life. And so what we're seeing is people say, I want more, I insist on more. And that is creating not only is it creating the freelance revolution, but it's creating multiple revolutions in multiple ways. I wish I had better advice than buckle up, but I think these days that is as good as any.
Oh, it was great. Thank you, John. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Rich. This was a very short and insightful conversation, at least for me. Personally, learned quite a bit. Looking forward to staying in touch with you guys and really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care, you guys.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.